had seen her. It slowed and walked closer, its head lowering to confirm her presence. It was then that she saw him. Astride the horse, half hidden under a huge brown waterproof and wide-brimmed hat, was Tom. He glanced over twice, as if making sure it was her, then pulled up. "You all right?" Kate had to fight the paralysis that his sudden appearance had provoked. Her voice, when it came, was glib and urban, distance from her true feelings. "Nothing that an umbrella, a complete change of clothes and a new life wouldn't cure." She pushed her hair back from her face. "I'm just waiting for the rain to die down so I can head back." "You look soaked." He shifted in the saddle. "Do you want to get up? This boy's good as gold. It'll get you back an awful lot faster." Kate eyed the huge grey horse, its plate-sized hooves moving restlessly too close to her feet, its massive head shaking up and down with impatience to get out of the rain. Its eyes swiveled, flashing hints of white, while its breath came in shots of hot steam like a dragon's. "Thanks, I think I'll wait." Tom sat very still. She could feel his eyes upon her and felt disadvantaged being so far beneath him. She wiped at her glasses. "I'm fine, honest." "You can't hang around here. This rain's not going. It's settling in. You could be waiting all night. Tom, please." But he had leant forward, swung his leg over the back of the saddle and dismounted. Holding the horse's reins in one hand, he walked over to her, his boots squelching in the wet earth, and pulled the brown hat from his head. "Here," he said, "take this." He rubbed his wet hand through his short dark hair so that it stood up in short, sleek spikes. "And this." He had removed his waterproof and thrust it at her. She took it wordlessly, gazing at him in his thick jumper, already dusted with the first drops to force their way through the sparse canopy above. It was impossible to tell about his arm, she noted, unless you looked at that hand. "Go on, put it on," he said. "I'll walk you back. You'll get soaked, but not for long. If you stay here in that thing," he pointed dismissively at her jacket, warm enough for the worst that London could throw at it, "you'll catch pneumonia. Come on, it's sheltering rain. I feel, she hesitated, "cold, wet. Go on. The quicker you do, the quicker we can get back." She put on the coat. Cut to cover the saddle as well as its passenger, it reached down almost to her ankles and swished around her shins. He grinned as she placed the hat on her head. "Why don't you trot back?" she said pleadingly. "Then you won't get so wet. I'm fine with this lot on." "I'll walk you back," he said firmly, and she decided not to argue any more. They followed the stream, their silence punctuated by the slop-clop of the horse's hooves and the occasional metallic jangle of his bit against his teeth. Beyond the hedge, the mist had come down, so that where one could usually make out Kilcarrion's distant chimneys, only a silent grey nothingness remained. Despite herself, Kate shivered. "Is there a reason why you're out on your own?" They were having to speak unnaturally loudly, shout almost, to be heard above the thrumming of the rain. "As opposed to being on a horse?" He laughed. "You know what I mean." Kate stared at her boots. Her footfall trudged sludgily out of rhythm. "It's not very easy," she said eventually. "Coming back, I mean."
"That's for sure."
"So why did you?" She stopped and looked at him. "Why did you come back?"
Tom, who had also been watching his feet, squinted up at her, then looked away. "Ah, too long a story. We've got at least half an hour, unless a taxi comes past." "True. But you first."
"Well, I came back because my father is dying, or at least I think he's dying. But you probably know more about that than I do."
She stared at him, but he shrugged as if in contradiction. His jumper, she noted guiltily, had started to hang lower from the extra weight of the water.
"And I want you to see Sabine. But something seems to have happened while she's been here, and she..."
Kate lifted her head, trying to keep the choke from her voice.
"She doesn't seem to want to come back."
There, she had acknowledged it. She glanced at him, waiting for some response, some suggestion of judgment on his part. But he just kept walking, staring down at his feet. Kate sighed. I can't say I blame her. There's been a lot of upheaval at home. I left my partner for someone else, and then he turned out... he turned out to be not what I'd expected. So I ended up on my own. She tripped and looked up at him, trying to smile. Probably no great surprise to you. But Tom kept walking. She hesitated again, fighting the swelling urge to cry. Still, I thought she'd be pleased. I thought she'd want to come back and just be the two of us, because she's never really liked anyone I've been with. And I thought she'd hate it here with all the rules and stupid deadlines for meals and hunting. I always wanted her to grow up free of all that, you see. None of that rigidity, none of that formality, none of that constant sense of things being either right or wrong. I just wanted her to be happy, to be my friend. But here she pulled up her spectacles and wiped a finger under her eyes, grateful that under the broad brim of the hat it would look as if she was struggling with the rain. She seems to have liked it. In fact, she seems to prefer it to living with me. So the reason I'm out here in the rain is, frankly, because I feel a bit of a spare part. I don't know what to do with myself, and I don't know what I'm going to do with myself. And I don't think anyone here really knows what to do with me. She let out a long, shuddering breath. Bit of a mess, really, she said apologetically. Tom, one arm now thrown over the low-hung neck of his horse, appeared to be deep in thought, oblivious to the rivulets of water running from his hair down the lines of his jaw and dripping onto his collar. They walked on in silence until they reached a five-barred gate, which, solicitously, he opened, holding his horse back and away from her until she'd gone through. "Stupid, really," she said, needing to fill the silence now that the deluge had eased off. She didn't think the countryside could be this quiet. "There's me, 35 years old and still not able to sort my life out. You'd think I would have worked it out by now. My brother has. Most of my friends have. Sometimes I think I'm the only person who has not been given the set of rules, you know? The ones that show you how to grow up." Her voice, she realized, had risen. She had begun to babble. "Are you not going to say anything?" she said, once he'd shut the gate behind them. He looked at her. His eyes, outlined by wet black lashes, were surprisingly blue. Or perhaps it was just that everything around them seemed so grey. "What do you want me to say?" he said. It sounded peculiarly like a genuine question. A quarter of a mile away, in a room only slightly less damp, Sabine and Joy were going through some of the album photographs. It had been at Joy's suggestion, which surprised Sabine, but then lots of things about Joy's behaviour surprised her these days. That she had accepted Sabine's plan to go out with a boy without a murmur. That she had suddenly started letting the dogs, to their apparent relish, sleep nights on her bed. That she wanted to do almost anything rather than sit in the same room as her husband, whom she adored. Sabine stared at the formal photograph of the couple on their 6th wedding anniversary. Joy was seated on a stool, dressed in a dark button-down dress, with a wide striped collar and full skirt, and her smile suggested repressed mirth. He, again in whites, stood behind her, one hand on her shoulder, the other clasping hers with a kind of loose affection. He was looking down at the top of her head and also trying not to laugh. "He was the most awful photographer," said Joy fondly, wiping non-existent dust from the page. "He was a lovely Chinese fellow, but with the most terrible English expressions that the troops must have told him meant something quite different. He thought he was telling you to sit closer together, but he'd say some awful piece of slang, like..." Joy glanced at Sabine. "Anyway, your grandfather and I had terrible trouble keeping a straight face. If I remember rightly, we absolutely howled afterwards." Sabine stared at the picture, reanimating it in her imagination, into the two laughing lovers, conspiring in their mirth, erupting in some joint emotion as they emerged, blinking into the sunlight. It was as if they had some invisible shield around them, as if their happiness left no room for anyone else to get in. "I want a man to look at me like that," Sabine thought. "I want to feel that loved." "Did you and Grandfather never argue?"
Joy folded the tissue paper back over the page.
"Of course we did. Well, not argue as such, more disagree."
She looked up and out of the window. "I think it was a bit easier for our generation, Sabine. We knew what our roles were. There wasn't all this fussing and fighting over who did what that you seem to get today.
Plus you had servants. No moaning over who did the washing up."
"No, that did help."
"But he must have upset you sometimes. You must have hated each other's guts sometimes. No one's perfect."
"I never hated his guts, as you so charmingly put it."
"But you must have rowed. Everyone rows."
"Please don't let it just be my mother," she said silently. Joy compressed her mouth as if considering her words carefully. "There was a day, one day, in which your grandfather upset me very much." Sabine waited for an explanation of this dreadful deed, but none was forthcoming. Then Joy drew breath and continued. "I was very, very unhappy afterwards, and I thought, why on earth should I stay? Why should I stick this out? It's too difficult. And then this ridiculous phrase came to me, from the coronation ceremony. You know, we were rather obsessed by the coronation when we were young. And as I understood it at the time, it was about the need to stick with something to get your reward. It was about duty and honour. And I thought of how excited everyone had been at this young woman giving up her life with her dashing husband to fulfil her duty, to rule over her temporal kingdom, as they put it. And I realised it wasn't just about oneself, about one's own happiness. It was about not letting everyone else down, about keeping other people's dreams alive." She gazed out of the window into the distance, held briefly captive by her own memories. "So I stuck with it. And all those people who would have been disappointed if I hadn't. Well, I think they were happier as a result."
"But what about you?" Sabine wanted to say.
But suddenly her grandmother became rather brusque.
"Good gracious, look at that rain," she said. "I had no idea. Come on, we've got to get those horses out of the bottom field. You can help me before you go out."
Chapter 11. Thomas Keneally had left Ireland aged 19, without money or job prospects, bound for Lambourne in England, where, he was assured by his fellow jockeys, a man with his light hands and, more importantly, bollocks of steel, would find work as a jump jockey. He left behind him a good job, at least two offers of work from reputable Irish trainers, and his distraught parents, who, while acknowledging that teenage sons grew up and moved away, had always assumed it would be his elder brother, Kieran, who went first. Tom's father had hoped it would be. Kieran had crashed his car twice now, and never, unlike Tom, gave his mother a portion of his wages towards housekeeping. Both parents declined to ask their younger son why he was leaving, but had been discreetly informed by his Aunt Ellen, who worked at the big house, that it might have something to do with the daughter. For this reason, Tom's mother, until she died almost 9 years later, bore a weighty, if silent, grudge against Kate Ballantyne. Even though Tom had never so much as mentioned her, she had met her all of twice, and Kate herself had left Ballymolnoe under a cloud some months before Tom. There was the baby, of course, but Tom, unusually, had nearly bitten her head off when she had asked whether it was anything to do with him. Even then he wasn't the kind of lad you pushed for answers. As predicted, he had found work fairly easily, in the 40-strong yard of a well-known woman trainer,
who combined a twinkling ability to flirt with everyone down to her animals, the stamina and build of a cart horse, and a temper that could sear third-degree burns on raw skin. She liked Tom. He was straightforward, good with the horses, and most of all, not afraid of her. There was some resentful gossip among the existing lads that she liked him for better reasons than that, but Tom was so fiercely ambitious and so hard-working that it was difficult for anyone who spent any time with either rider or trainer to take them seriously. He was not, as the racing crowd put it, one of the boys. He neither disappeared with his colleagues to the pub on a Friday night to dissolve their meagre wages in beer, nor brought local girls back for raucous after-hours drinks to the side-by-side cramped and badly heated mobile homes that passed for their accommodation, nor sat with mugs of artificially sweetened black coffee after morning stables, complaining about the poor pay and back-breaking hours that were the trainee jockey's lot. He worked, studied form books, rode out at every opportunity, and sent back to his parents what little money he had over. It was, even he had to admit afterwards, pretty nauseating behaviour. Which was why, when 4 years later, a bad-tempered four-year-old by the name of Never on Sunday panicked in the stalls and went over, crushing Tom's arm so badly that it was left hanging by two tendons and a shattered bone. The only person who really grieved for him was the lady trainer. She was also grieving for herself. She hadn't had anyone work as hard as him the whole time she'd been in business. And the bookies, who had long noted Tom's uncanny yet gratifyingly predictable ability to bring a horse home in second place. The other lads, while sympathetic, it could have been one of them after all, harboured a silent sense of schadenfreude and told each other reassuringly in hushed tones that being teacher's pet got you nowhere. Tom spent a large part of the following year in hospital, at first fighting off an infection that had resulted from the amputation, and later having his false limb fitted. He did not, it is fair to say, adjust well immediately to his new handicap, despite the efforts of the lady trainer, who, showing an unlikely loss of her customary hard-headedness, which led even Tom to question whether he had been wrong in his assessment of her feelings towards him, told him he could have a job for life working in her yard. That offer became slightly less fervent after Tom started drinking. It was withdrawn completely after, following 12 pints of Australian lager and a brief messy interlude with a barmaid who claimed she could tell certain things about him from his shoe size, he drove the lady trainer's Range Rover into a ditch in the early hours of the morning, writing it off in the process. He then walked home, ignoring the wound to his head, and the fact that the vehicle's alarm was heralding a new dawn for half of Berkshire, and was still asleep on his blood-sodden sheets when the lady trainer broke into his mobile home and asked him, except she didn't exactly ask him, to pack his bags. After that, he worked at a number of yards, less reputable ones, that cared little about his increasing reputation for drinking and womanizing, and thought they could capitalise on his earlier shrinking one for hard work and effectiveness with horses. He usually managed to disappoint them within 6 months. He was always good with horses, but difficult with the other lads, mercurial in temper, and, worst of all, frequently rude to owners. The last lad to crack a joke about his false arm found himself hanging upside down from a bridle-cleaning hook, with a hoof-pick parked somewhere that swiftly became the stuff of local legend. This downward spiral culminated in his last posting, working for a trainer, also from Ireland, whose methods and company had raised eyebrows in the kind of horse-racing circles that Tom had once been used to. Now, handicapped more by his reputation than his arm, and determined to ignore his parents' requests to come home, he found himself accepting J.C. Kermode's offer of a position with what passed for alacrity. J.C. was a short, wiry former jockey with a brain as sharp as the metal teeth of a currycomb and a patter as smooth as hoof oil. It did not take long for Tom to realize that these two gifts, essential in any trainer, might be less admirable when joined by an ability to bend the truth like Uri Geller with an old spoon. JC's greatest gift was not training horses, his record was dismal, but the ability to persuade gullible new owners not only to park their horses with him, but to buy more, and then to ignore the ever-mounting yard bills he managed to ratchet up as part of their special training routine. The climactic example of these were Dean and Dolores, a socially climbing couple of divorcees from Solihull, next to whom J.C. had sat on a plane from Dublin. By the time the plane had landed, he had persuaded them that they would have the best laugh accompanying him racing at Uttoxeter, and that if they liked it, he had just the filly for them. Dean, the oversized and unlovely managing director of a kitchen utensil company, had rarely had anyone work so hard to convince him of his wonderful company. His new wife, Dolores, was still in shock from her divorce-related expulsion from Solihull's social crème de la crème, as she put it, and was deeply taken with JC's flirtatious manner and vocal admiration of Dean's business acumen. Before the air hostesses had asked them to fasten their seatbelts for landing, the pair had already pictured themselves in the winner's enclosure at Ascot. In Dolores's case, having smiled a glamorous smile to the television cameras, and hence to all those solly old bitches who stuck by her ex-husband. And J.C. was on his way to the sale of a particularly problematic three-year-old called Charlie's Darling, with a ewe neck and a vicious, unpredictable buck. If Dean and Dolores were J.C.'s cash cow, as he frequently described them to Tom, they were also to be his downfall. Although initially seduced by the racing scene and by the idea of themselves as owners, a view aided by Charlie's Darling's completely unforeseen win in the 3:30 cellar at Doncaster, and JC's tendency to bring Tom along, Dolores liked Tom. Gradually the huge bills accumulated by their string of four horses left Dean with something more than indigestion after their fun days out at the track. He was sure, he confided in a disbelieving Dolores, that J.C. was up to something. Dolores, whose racing day wardrobe now accurately reflected their jockey's colours, told him he was being ridiculous. But when Tom bored of flirting with her, it made him feel like an idiot, he mulishly told an exasperated J.C. She too questioned the beneficence of their great new friend, J.C. Then J.C.'s old friend from Ireland, Kenny Hanlon, appeared. He had got to hear about his old mate's financial good luck with these gullible British owners, and decided he'd quite like a slice of that particular pie. Best known for his rather controversial fruit machine rental firm, it was said that on nearly all his machines, one of his plums was missing, he began to turn up at race meetings. With a jovial greeting to J.C., he would slide into the seat so recently vacated by Tom and shower compliments on the increasingly insecure Dolores, ignoring J.C.'s silent fury on the other side of the table. For a man with two cauliflower ears, it was said, he had an astonishingly winning way with the fair sex. It was only a matter of weeks before he was dropping Iago-like hints into her own multiply pierced ear. Was she sure that J.C. wasn't adding a little something to the bill? He was renowned for it, she should know. Was she sure he was getting her the best horses, and not just the old nags? They hadn't had many winners lately, after all. Might she be interested in moving the horses somewhere else? He knew just the place, and he could guarantee that Dean's feed and vet's bill would drop by at least a third. And did she know quite how delicious she looked in that shade of mauve? Tom and J.C. woke one morning to discover a horse box in the process of removing the Solihull string of racehorses from their stables to go to another yard in Newmarket. Newly opened it was, the implacable driver said, as J.C. went purple with rage. Some fellow called Kenny Hanlon. It was at that point that things had got out of control. J.C. had punctured the horse box's tyres with a pitchfork, and the driver had called the police. There was a succession of nighttime raids between the two yards, lifting saddles, rugs, even a microwave oven, supposedly in lieu of payments on both sides. But when Kenny Hanlon was fingered by the authorities for supposed non-payment of tax on his fruit machine operations, a charge that resulted in a prison sentence of some 4 years and the subsequent burning down by suspected arsonists of J.C.'s yard, Tom decided he had had enough of the racing scene. He quit drinking and came home. He had told Kate this story, minus the bit about his late mother's feelings towards her, on the slow, wet walk back to Kilcarrion. A walk that had become even slower when, shortly before they reached the gateway to the house, he suggested they wait for a few moments in a deserted bus shelter. There, seated on the benches as the big grey horse dozed and occasionally accepted polo mints from Tom's hand, he had filled in somewhat less emotional terms than Kate had, the last 16 years or so of his life. After she commented that it was strange them both ending up here again, he had also stared for a disconcertingly long time into Kate's eyes, so that she blushed and felt temporarily unbalanced. But then she had been unbalanced by lots of her reactions to Tom, by the fact that increasingly, when she bumped into him around the house and its grounds, she found herself becoming more tongue-tied rather than less, and worse, that at least twice she had blushed, by the fact that his habit of staring at her very directly when he spoke left her unable to concentrate on what he was saying, by the fact that during the last few nights in the inaccurately named Italian room, unless they meant Venice, she thought, eyeing the latest spreading damp patch, it had been Tom's rather than Justin's face that she had found herself picturing. Had he always been so attractive? Or had the weathering of pain and suffering cast compelling new shadows on his face? Maggie had often accused her of being unhealthily attracted to those she termed walking wounded. Had he always been so good at listening, gazed at her so attentively? She couldn't say. The Tom she had known at 19 had been such a different, less confident character. And the Kate she had been so much more confident, so determinedly impulsive, so sure that bigger and better things awaited her. "You fool," she had told herself one afternoon as she lay on her bed like a teenager, contemplating such questions. "You're bloody incapable of existing anywhere without imagining some kind of flirtation. This is exactly what got you into so much trouble last time. This is exactly what Maggie has been criticising you for." So she had decided to avoid Tom, had busied herself in her room, working on long-standing writing projects she had brought with her, had borrowed her mother's car and taken herself off to explore some of the nearby sites, and, most importantly, had avoided the summer house, the back fields, the yard, anywhere, in fact, where she thought the slightest possibility existed that she might run into him. He had seemed not to notice at first, and then, as she was scuttling across the drive to the car one morning, he had materialized close to her, she jumped, and said, "Are you avoiding me?" She had denied it, had stuttered that of course she wasn't. She was busy. Had to pop into town, had an awful lot of work on. But he had just nodded and lifted an eyebrow, and she had known that he knew. And she had decided even more furiously that she should stay away from him, away from trouble. And had said yes when he asked if she'd like to go out for dinner. Annie's door was unlocked, as was normal. But Joy knocked on it twice, somewhat warily, before entering. She was not sure, given recent events, what to expect. When there was no response, she pushed it open and walked in, stopping on the threshold to give her eyes time to adjust to the dim light. The living room looked both neglected and as if some whirlwind had recently passed through, scattering books and papers over every available surface as it went. The curtains, which had not been opened, shrouded the room in gloom. The few thin slivers of light that sliced through, catching the particles of dust suspended by Joy's arrival. It looked like the scene of some great crime, resting quietly on its turbulent secrets.
"Annie," she said, clutching the tin of shortbread to her chest. She didn't often venture into the village these days, there being so much to do around the house, especially now that Sabine was helping her sort out all those old papers. More importantly, she suspected that it would be tempting fate to venture too far away. She had left her granddaughter with Edward, flicking through some of the old souvenirs he used to bring Joy when he returned home. He seemed to like spending time with Sabine. Sabine could sit in. Joy could manage everything outside. It made things so much simpler.
"Are you there?"
There was an answering rustle from the kitchen.
"Annie?"
"Hello?"
came a male voice. A head shot out from the doorway, that of a sharp-featured man with short, business-like hair, probably in his 40s. "I couldn't find anyone," he said apologetically, "so I thought I'd help myself to breakfast. I hope that's okay."
"Oh," said Joy. "I'm sure that's fine. You're a guest, are you?"
"Anthony Fleming," he said, thrusting out a hand.
He was wearing a wind cheater and the tightest pair of shorts Joy had ever seen. Brightly coloured and made of some kind of shining nylon, they moulded themselves around him, outlining the finer points of the man's anatomy in a manner that, had Joy been the type to blush, would have provoked a colour of damson-esque hues. Instead, she just blinked rather hard and looked away.
"Joy Ballantyne," she said, extending her own hand a little less forcefully. "I live across the road. Is Annie around?"
"I haven't seen her since last night," said the man, who had returned to his bowl of cereal.
"She let me in and found a place for my bike. I'm cycling around Ireland. But then there was no sign of her this morning. I'm a bit fed up, to be honest, as I've been hanging around for ages. And cornflakes and slightly off milk are not exactly my idea of bed and breakfast."
"Oh," said Joy,
unsure what she could offer this man in return.
"I'm afraid I can't help you there."
There was a short silence.
"Annie," she said slowly, "Annie's had a bit of bad luck lately. She's normally a little better organized."
She was aware of how weak these words sounded, faced with the chaos and grime around her.
"That may be," said Anthony Fleming, rinsing his bowl under the tap and adjusting his cycling shoes. "But I can't say I'll be rushing back. Not my idea of Irish hospitality. Not like the last place I stayed, in Enniscorthy. The White Horse, or house, I can't remember. Do you know it?"
Joy didn't, but the man, apparently placated by having been able to state his dissatisfactions to somebody, collected his bicycle from one of the outhouses and departed, having rather gallantly left Joy the full amount due for his overnight stop. After she had watched him cycle off down the road, she turned to the kitchen and looked at it properly for the first time. It was not a happy sight. Dishes piled up in the sink, half submerged in rank, greasy water, a stale, half-eaten loaf upside down on a plastic chopping board, a selection of cardboard wrappers from ready-made meals forming rickety multi-story towers on the surfaces that weren't littered with chocolate wrappers, stale crumbs or out-of-date pints of milk, the organic indicators of a disintegrating life. It wasn't a huge surprise. Mrs. H. had confided unhappily that Annie's husband Patrick had finally tired of a wife who no longer seemed to even notice he was there, a wife who neither wanted to share anything with him, talk to him, or even argue with him, and had left. "He's a good man," she had said as Joy stood by, a little uncomfortable with Mrs. H.'s unsolicited confidences, "and I can't blame him. Lately she tried the patience of a saint, floating around like she's in another world. She won't talk about Neve, won't admit that this is what's causing it.
She won't open up to him at all. Half the time she won't even talk to me.
It was Mrs. H.'s uncharacteristic and public grief that had prompted Joy's visit. Annie had got so bad the last week or so that she would not let her in, she said. So when Joy suggested that she pop around with a tin of biscuits, Mrs. H. had accepted gratefully.
She won't expect you, she said. She'd probably just open the door to you.
But what on earth do I tell her about this? Joy thought, gazing around her.
She didn't want to interfere. She wasn't the type. People should generally be left alone to sort themselves out, if that was what they wanted. But this...
Annie, she said, letting herself out of the back door into the kitchen garden. The vegetable patch, from which Annie had once prided herself on conjuring ripe green produce, now looked bare and infertile. The grassed area spilled over messily into the borders, where the browned, brittle remains of the summer's plant life wound itself sadly through the earth. She backed into the house, closing the door behind her. The utility room, once competently stocked with toilet rolls, kitchen rolls, sacks of potatoes, was cold and almost empty. The dining room bore a thin sheen of dust.
Annie, she called up the stairs, are you there?
Neve's room was the last that Joy entered. Anyone who knew Annie felt unwilling to go into it, not because of any superstition about the little girl who had once lived there, but because of an awareness of the depth and fragility of Annie's grief. Someone who had lost a child, went village wisdom, should be allowed to grieve in whichever way they chose. The awfulness was so unimaginable that, unlike with other life events, weddings, christenings, disappearing spouses, no one felt qualified to suggest a right or wrong way of dealing with it.
Annie, she said.
Annie was sitting on the carefully made child's bed, her back to the door and a plastic doll in her right hand. She didn't turn around immediately when Joy spoke her name, but continued to stare out of the window at the brown fields beyond, as if she hadn't heard. Joy stood in the doorway, taking in the toys, the brightly coloured curtains, the curling wall posters, unsure whether to venture further in. She already felt like she was intruding.
"Are you all right?" she asked tentatively.
Annie's head moved slightly to the right, as if she were examining the doll. She lifted it slowly and ran her finger over its face.
"I keep meaning to do some dusting," she said. "It's a bit of a mess in here."
She turned her head so that she could see Joy, smiling a strange, bleak smile.
"Housework, eh? It always gets away from you."
Annie looked pale and tired, her hair lank over her face, and her movements slow and precise, as if the very act of moving at all exhausted her. She sat awkwardly, swaddled in her usual layers, bound up as if in an attempt to further remove the world outside. Joy, who had hardly seen her since the quarrel with Sabine, wondered with a heavy heart at how grief could transform someone from the bright, sparky young mother of 3 years previously to this seemingly drugged automaton. It made her think of Edward, too, and she swatted away the thought.
I've brought you some biscuits. It sounded so ridiculous. But Annie didn't seem remotely surprised. Shortbread. How lovely.
I wasn't sure how you were. We've not seen much of you lately.
There was a long pause, during which Annie examined the doll's face very carefully, as if for damage.
I wondered if you needed any help with anything. Shopping, perhaps. Or,
she didn't like to say cleaning with its implications, a bit of company.
Sabine always loves to see you. Perhaps I could send her over later.
She remembered the money in her hand.
Oh, and a Mr. Fleming, your guest, left this for you.
She held out her hand, and then, meeting no response, stepped forward and placed it on the dressing table.
"How's Mr. Valentine?" Annie said suddenly.
Joy took a deep breath.
"He's fine, thank you. A little better."
"That's grand."
She placed the doll carefully on the bed and turned towards the window again. Joy was unsure whether she was being dismissed. Eventually, she stepped forward, thrust the tin of shortbread onto the bed. The poor girl's thoughts were elsewhere. There was little that Joy could do. She would tell Mrs. H. that Annie needed help, perhaps even to be taken to her parents' home for a while.
Perhaps she should have some... what was it they all had these days? Counselling.
Quietly, her footfall muffled by the thick carpet, Joy turned to leave the room.
"Patrick's left me, you know," came the voice.
Joy turned back. Annie still faced the window. It was impossible to see her expression.
"I just thought you should know," she said.
There were two dates leaving Kilcarrion House on Saturday night, although both parties would have been at pains not to let them be described as such. Sabine had decided she would go out with Bobby McAndrew, had accepted his offer of a trip to the pictures, helped choose the film from the local paper, then spent the following days worrying about whether he would try to seat her in the back row and stick his hand down her top. She wasn't sure, but she thought she might have gone off him again. "I'm going to wear my black jumper, the polo neck one, so that he doesn't get any ideas," she had told her grandfather. "And my jeans, so that I don't look like I've tried or anything."
Her grandfather's eyes had swiveled across to her. Behind him, the technology, encased in its plastic surround, bleeped a regular pulse.
"Don't look at me like that," she said scoldingly. "It's perfectly smart for nowadays, just because you lot used to wear suits and stuff to go out."
Her grandfather had looked away again. Sabine had grinned at him and placed his hand back on the bedspread.
"Besides, if he's a right pug, I want to make myself look as horrible as I can."
But Bobby McAndrew hadn't looked terribly puggy. He had worn a pair of dark green trousers, dark brown heavy-soled boots, and his own black woolen polo neck, which had made her want to giggle. Perhaps he was terrified that she was going to jump on him. He had also driven his own car, which was quite impressive. It was only a little Vauxhall, but it was a nice colour. And Sabine, who had never been on a date with anyone who drove before, she hadn't actually been on that many dates, full stop, quite enjoyed the feeling of maturity conveyed by a boyfriend with wheels. She also liked the chivalrous way that Bobby reminded her to do up her seatbelt, when her mother reminded her she was being a nag. She leant forward and turned on the stereo, and the voice of a famous female singer had flooded the car, warbling on about lost love and sleepless nights. Listening, Sabine had realised with a start that it was well over a month since she had heard any pop music. The woman's voice, once one of her favourites, sounded almost alien, a bit self-indulgent and silly. She had leant forward again and turned it off.
"You don't like music," said Bobby, glancing over at her.
He smelt of aftershave. It wasn't too awful.
"Not really in the mood for it," she had replied, and gazed coolly out of the window, quietly pleased with the way that sounded. The showing had been on early. The film had been funny enough to make her laugh, without thinking, and Bobby had failed to embarrass himself or her by clammy handing her in the dark. She had spent much of the first half on the edge of her seat, primed to retaliate. So when he asked if she fancied a pizza, Sabine said yes. No one had told her what time she had to be back. And at Kilcarrion, such opportunities were to be relished. She also, she admitted, didn't mind spending a bit more time with Bobby. It was good after all this time to hang out with someone her own age, even if she had forgotten quite how irritating teenage boys could be.
"Vegetarian, are you?" said Bobby, eyeing her choice of pizza over his menu. Yes.
So?
And you hunt?
She sighed, gazed around her at the bustling restaurant. The waitress had looked at her as if she were too young to be there.
I went once to see what it was like, and we didn't catch anything, did we?
Do you wear leather shoes? He leant down as if to peer under the table.
Yes, I do.
Until they make decent rubber ones, I don't have much choice.
Do you eat wine gums?
You know they're made out of bits of cows.
It's the gelatine in them.
Sabine grimaced, wishing Bobby would change the subject.
He had done this non-stop since they left the cinema, this conversation as battle thing, joking and trying to score points off her.
It had made her laugh at first. Now it was becoming exhausting.
Do you ever stop going on? She said, with a smile to take the sting out of her words.
Going on?
I just don't eat meat. I don't want to fight about it.
Point taken. He had looked up at her from under his lashes, the faintest flicker of embarrassment showing on his face. From behind him, the waitress, who had stacked shoes and too much makeup, dropped a glass of Coke heavily onto the table.
So how's the old man? I hear he's on his last legs.
He's all right, Sabine felt strangely defensive.
How come you're so interested in my family, anyway?
I told you, London girl. Here we like to know everything about everyone's business. Nosy.
No, just efficient gatherers of information.
Knowledge is power, you know.
I'd rather have money.
He ran a finger around the edge of his plate.
Actually, I asked because I wanted to know when you'd be going back to England.
Sabine paused, her fork halfway to her mouth.
Well, common sense says that if he... Well, if you're here to help look after him and he... Well, I heard you'd probably be heading off soon.
Why should you care? Sabine wanted to ask him, but it seemed too forward.
He's not dying, if that's what you're saying. So you'll be around a while. I mean, your mum's not dragging you home with her.
My mum doesn't have any say over what I do, said Sabine pertly, skewering a piece of mushroom on her fork.
I could stay here forever if I wanted.
You don't miss London too much, then? Sabine thought for a moment.
Actually, apart from a couple of my mates, I don't miss it at all.
It got easier after that. Bobby's manic conversational duelling eased off. And talking to him became more like talking to one of her friends. He still mugged at her and did too many silly voices, and was a bit what Mrs. H. would call excitable. But he looked at her in a nice way, and she decided as they drove home that if he tried to stick his tongue in her mouth, she probably wouldn't hit him or anything. Not too hard, anyway.
So where's your dad?
He said. They had been singing to one of his tapes, which had just stopped while it turned itself over.
My real dad?
I don't see him.
What?
Not at all.
Nope.
Did he and your mom have a falling out or what?
Not really.
Sabine traced her finger around the steam on her window, writing her initials in curly lettering.
I don't think they were together very long before I came along. And I think he didn't really want to be a dad, and she didn't really want him involved anyway. Plus she wanted to live in England.
This was the official version. The version her mum had told her back during her early teens, when she had been briefly fascinated by her origins.
You don't mind?
Bobby looked incredulous.
Why should I? I've never met him. If someone didn't want to be my dad, I'm hardly going to go chasing after him, am I?
Do you know who he is?
I don't know his name. I think my mum did tell me, but I've forgotten. I think he was an artist, though.
Sabine wasn't being purposely vague. Her paternity, to her, genuinely wasn't a big deal. In London, there were loads of people her age who didn't have any contact with their real dads. The only times it had bothered her had been when she was much younger, and had wondered why her family wasn't like the ones in her books. She'd thought about him a bit since coming to Ireland. It was inevitable when she knew that he lived somewhere nearby. But it was like she said... Sabine had far too much pride to go chasing after someone who had never been interested in her. Besides, she knew such reunions didn't often work out. She'd seen the talk shows. But she didn't tell him the other bit. The bit her mum had told her when she was a bit tipsy. That they had got together when she had been his model.
The only other boy she confided that to had got all unnecessary and started going on about topless shots and whether her mum was a bit of a goer. Sabine didn't think Bobby would do that, but she didn't know him well enough to be sure. Bobby was silent for a minute, checking the mirrors as he indicated and headed towards Ballymalnoe. According to the clock on his dashboard, it was nearly 11:15. She hoped no one was going to get funny about it when she got home. "Dads are a right bore, anyhow," he said, looking straight ahead. "You're probably better off without one. Mine's always on my case about stuff. Too much aggro, you know?" Sabine nodded as if she did. She knew he was being kind because he felt badly for her. But that was okay. The other date was not going quite so smoothly. In fact, it was not going at all. Having stood in front of her reflection in her room for some 3/4 hour, Kate had decided that she could not go out to dinner with Tom. There was Christopher for a start. He was due back this evening, and the moment he discovered her plans for the evening, he would be proffering barbed comments and declaiming indiscreetly to Julia that it was only to be expected of her. There was her mother, whose discovery of Kate going below stairs, as she would see it, no doubt, could only make their already cool relationship frostier. She hadn't liked it when Kate had gone out as a teenager with Tom. She was unlikely to like it any better now. It was probably not the done thing to go out with men anyway, when your father was supposedly dying. She should be spending her time sitting by the bedside looking pained. But that would displace Sabine, who already spent most of her time up there, and seemed to get irritated whenever she offered to help. And Kate had to admit to being secretly relieved that no one seemed to want her to spend any time with him. They had hardly spoken since she left home, and he had made it clear that that was not likely to change. But it wasn't just that this date was inappropriate in so many ways. More importantly, it would just reaffirm all the worst beliefs that she harboured about herself, that she was incapable of functioning without a man, that she seemed to seek out the unsuitable, that she allowed herself to be so much flotsam and jetsam on the great turbulent sea of romance. "It's time I took charge," Kate told herself, eyeing her complexion, which had begun to dry out in the cold. "It's time I learnt to live on my own, to put my daughter first, to be a responsible adult, whatever that means." What would Maggie do? She wondered. A question she often asked herself, and one that had prompted the premature ending of her relationship with Justin. Not that he had been unduly devastated by it. She would have cancelled, she concluded, refusing to acknowledge the tiny sting of disappointment that virtual Maggie's verdict invoked. She would definitely have cancelled. In fact, there was no way that you could look at it and not end up with Maggie cancelling. She knew. She tried. Kate took a deep breath, pulled another jumper over her head, and went out into the yard to find Tom. "I can't come." It was a little balder than she had intended. Tom was stringing up a hay net in one of the stables, under the watery light of a flickering electric bulb. Behind him, the big grey horse she had seen that wet day in the copse ran an inquiring rubbery muzzle around the remains of his feed bucket. Tom didn't look round.
"Why?"
"Because it's a bit difficult. I've got to look after Sabine."
"Sabine's out on a date."
He finished tying a knot in the hay net, twisted it a couple of times, and then with a slap on the horse's rump, walked out of the stable, sliding the two bolts into place behind him. The yard, which was now dark and almost empty, echoed under his footsteps. Kate stood still, her mouth half open.
"You didn't know? She's gone out with one of the MacAndrew brothers. He's a good lad. You don't need to worry."
Hurt, fury and humiliation impacted themselves upon Kate like a car crash, mangling her confidence and self-possession. Sabine hadn't even mentioned this boy to her, yet the whole house had known she was going out with him. How did it make her look? To be her mother, yet the last person to find out. What had she done to Sabine to make her want to wound her so? Loss of face, Maggie called it. very important in Asian circles. Sabine had ensured that Kate had virtually no face left. Worse, she had shown her up to be a liar. Tom walked on to the next stable, so that despite her wrong-footedness, she was forced to follow him. He opened the door, peered in, then pulled out a half-empty water bucket. "So why else can't you come?" he said, using his good arm to sluice the water down the drain. Kate looked at him, trying to determine whether there was any anger in his tone. There didn't seem to be. "It's just too complicated," she said briskly. Tom picked up the bucket with his good hand and placed it back inside the stable, shutting the door behind him. He stopped for a minute, leaning against the metal covering that ran along the top. "Because?" His eyes were soft, hinting at amusement. His short dark hair was sprinkled with hay seeds like the pelt of an animal. Confined in her pockets, her hands itched silently to rub at it. "Don't make me do this," Kate pleaded silently. "Don't make me start going through the reasons. Tom?"
"Look, it's not a big deal. It was just a bite to eat. I thought you were looking fed up, and I know your family aren't the easiest lot. It was just meant to give you a bit of a break.
Don't worry about it." He walked on to the next stable, leaving her behind him in the yard.
"Another time, eh?" he shouted over his shoulder, cheerfully.
Kate stood, overwhelmed by a feeling of stupidity. She had misread it. He had just been offering a friendly couple of hours away from her family. Like her brother said, why did she assume the world revolved around her? She shifted her weight on her feet, aware of a growing numbness in her toes, yet unwilling to disappear into the house. "Go on," a silent voice urged her. "Don't you dare," said virtual Maggie. "Tom?"
"Yep."
He was in the tack room now, stuck out his head as she drew nearer. His expression was blank, friendly. "I could murder a drink, though." He paused, and again she felt that same disorientated sensation as his gaze settled on her face. "Fine. So you'll come? We can just have a drink."
"I'll meet you at the Black Hen. You remember where it is?"
He was laughing at her. It was the only pub in the village.
"At about," he checked his watch. 7:30, then. See you up there."
Kate walked up the unlit road towards the pub, playing with her glasses in her pocket, placing them back on her nose, then just as swiftly removing them and putting them back in her pocket. It was a less stationary repeat of her performance an hour earlier, when she had sat in front of her dressing table, trying to tame her hair, alternately putting on and rubbing off her makeup, and wondering whether, in some immensely subtle way, she had just been outmanoeuvred. He had seemed genuinely unbothered as to whether they went out or not, which meant that this was obviously not a date. But it still wouldn't have looked good on paper. Recently separated mother arrives home, father on deathbed, goes out with good-looking man within 10 days of arrival. Everyone else would assume it was a date. And even if she knew it wasn't, she still didn't like the thought of having to go out with her unflattering glasses on. Off, she had decided. Even if it wasn't a date, there was no reason why she shouldn't look attractive. After the Justin debacle, her self-esteem needed all the padding it could get. On, she thought as she found herself walking gently into a hedge. Off, she decided as she reached the door of the Black Hen, and pushed the wrong side of it for some minutes before it was opened from the inside by someone making their way out. Because her eyesight was so inept, Kate's hearing was finely tuned to pick up the subtle but distinct lulling conversation as she walked into the warm, fuggy atmosphere of the pub. But the other advantage of not being able to see properly was that it made one remarkably impervious to what other people thought. Unable to make out the interested expressions on the faces of those around her, which often culminated in the odd murmur of recognition, Kate moved more confidently through the smoke-locked bar, and snug, than most women walking into such an establishment on their own, and in the Black Hen there was not much in the way of competition.
There were disadvantages, however. Namely, that one tended to trip over unmarked steps, career into those drinkers precariously transferring their rounds from the bar, and find it near impossible to locate in the dim light the person one was seeking. She was left with a thorny question of whether to admit defeat and pull out her glasses, thereby publicly admitting her vanity, or carry on regardless, squinting as she tried to negotiate the blurred boundaries of table and body. "I'm sorry," she said, clutching at a man's elbow, after she had knocked most of his pint over his shoes. "Please let me get you another."
"No, let me," said a voice. And through the dim light and cigarette haze, Kate gratefully made out the shape of Tom's face. "I'm over here," he said, steering her through the tables towards his own. "Sit down and I'll get you a drink."
Kate tried to decide whether to pull her glasses out of her pocket. In this darkened pub, her usual struggles to see what was around